I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. For 30 years, tourists and other visitors coming through Orlando's International Airport transformed what was a small town into a regional air traffic hub. More than 30 million passengers journey through the airport annually on their way in and out of Central Florida. 3 decades ago, that wasn't the case. Most vacationers arrived in their cars, driving on I-4 or the Florida Turnpike. This week on Intersection, Orlando International Airport's executive director tells us what's next for the airport and how local leaders acquired the future airport's land for a mere dollar. That story from a local historian and the congressman who helped orchestrate the deal. Those conversations ahead on Intersection. The Orlando International Airport marked 30 years this month. Since it was completed in 1981, the airport has doubled its acreage, and passenger traffic has gone up 600% from 6 million passengers in 81 to 35 million this year. Here to talk about the airport and its future is Phil Brown, Executive Director of the Greater Orlando Aviation Authority. Phil, what makes the Orlando Airport physically different or the passenger experience different from other airports in the U.S.?
I think what makes it different is what we call the Orlando experience. When the plans for this airport location were being developed in the mid-70s, there were 41 design criteria specifically included in the design package that addressed certain things such as use of natural light, use of Florida vegetation, minimizing passenger walking distances, having an established decor that was conducive with the Florida environment.
And how much has the Orlando International Airport changed since that opening in the early 80s?
Well, I mean, from a physical standpoint, we've added 2 runways, we've added 2 fire stations, we've added 2 air air sides, we've doubled the size of the landside terminal and built a hotel, and added about 7,000 acres as well.
And so what's been the impact of those changes?
Well, it's given us the capacity to bring more air service into Central Florida and the region, and that's really one of our primary focuses because the economic impact of that air service is multiplied throughout the region's economy. As an example, we have 1 international flight from Sao Paulo, Brazil, that based on our econometric models generates about $124 million annually in economic impact to the Central Florida region.
How far built out or to capacity is the current structure of the Orlando International Airport? Are you starting to max out at this point?
We're not starting to max out, but what has stood us in good stead over the years is a long-term vision and long-term planning. So we have just recently begun a master plan update to look at our facilities to consider very closely where we need to be in the next 5, 10, and 20 years in terms of facilities. As an integral part of that, we have to have an assessment of what the demand is going to be, what kind of passenger traffic they're going to have, and in conjunction with that, what type of aircraft are going to be using this facility. The other thing that we frankly need to plan on and working toward is our connection to rail.
Well, elaborate a little bit more for me on that, if you would. You know, this current economic moment, we've seen, you know, people are spending less, they're traveling less, but you're trying to predict for the future. So does this make it a difficult time to try to anticipate what needs are going to be if you're in a moment where you're seeing things declining a little bit?
Well, predicting the future is always difficult to do with any degree of accuracy, and the further out that you look in your planning horizon, the more difficult it is. So we take an approach that we have to be very cautious about our growth estimates going in the near term, because you're right, there have been some economic challenges that we've dealt with in the recent past. We will continue to see factors such as oil prices affecting that. You know, consumer demand is going to be a major impact on that, and to the extent that consumers are uncertain or they don't have jobs, it'll affect the demand. But what we need to try and do is look at the longer term as to those macroeconomic factors that are going to drive growth in Central Florida. And part of it is, frankly, we're going to have to go out and market this destination, along with some of our community partners, Visit Orlando, the EDC, City of Orlando, Orange County, to try and bring business here. And so part of it is you can sit and wait or you can be active. We've tried to be active along with our community partners to sort of induce some demand, if you will. We've got a lot of attractions here, certainly from the leisure sector of the economy, but things such as Medical City, which focus on business and have opportunities for us to grow business, those are things that we can go out and market from the standpoint that there are things that people can come and do in Central Florida that certainly are tourist-related, but also business-related.
Phil, you mentioned some things that might be coming to the airport that would require, it sounds like, physical changes. One of those different airplanes. I'm thinking of that big Airbus airliner that you have to have capacity for. I wonder, does that mean changes to terminals and changes to runways, but also the rail idea with SunRail coming in? Of course, we'd be looking at the possibility of finding some way to connect with the Orlando International Airport. Talk to me a little bit about those future physical changes you might be trying to anticipate.
Well, right now we can accommodate the A380, which is the largest commercial Airbus aircraft. We actually had one that diverted from Miami because of weather and came up to Orlando to refuel. As a part of our master plan update, which I previously referenced, we're looking at other terminal improvements that we may need to accommodate that. Our view right now, based on some preliminary evidence, is that particularly with European traffic, that you're going to see more and more of those large aircraft, which we call wide-body aircraft, and we're going to have to look at future facilities that accommodate that. That growth, based on what we've seen the last couple of years, is not necessarily going to be rapid, but it's going to be steady, and so we need to plan to accommodate that. In terms of the rail, we're actively working with the Florida Department of Transportation, Orange County, City of Orlando, on an alternatives analysis to see how it best to connect commuter rail into Orlando International Airport. That's something that we're funding part of a study for that. As you probably know, we were very actively engaged with Florida Rail Enterprise on the high-speed rail project. We had a site selected for a station, which was going to be co-located with our future South Terminal site. It really basically underscores our effort to have plans ready to accommodate growth as it occurs.
At this point on the rail concept, do you foresee a physical, you know, rail link hooking up with SunRail, or do you think it's going to be in a particular bus route, or what do you envision is going to be the immediate solution to that?
Well, I'm not sure that we have a clear. That's why we're doing the alternatives analysis. It may be both of the above. And in many cases, you may have a rubber tire system that is the initial connection, and then supplant that with a rail connection. There's, you know, it'll take time to build the rail. The key, I think, is the right-of-way rail. We have plans that will accommodate, and as a part of the process we went through with high-speed rail, we'd already worked pretty heavily or in pretty much detail on an alignment for commuter rail into the airport. So a lot of this, obviously, is going to be dictated by economics and how soon they want to have the system up and running, and I think the planning process that we're going through in terms of the alternative analysis will answer some of those questions.
Do you think a physical rail link could be in place by the time SunRail opens?
I think it's possible. The question is clearly going to be on funding and how you get the funding in place and how that's all accomplished. And until we have some better idea on when SunRail is going to come in and how it's going to come in and what's going to be needed in terms of right-of-way and where it's going to be located, it's hard to say that it can be ready, a rail link can be ready when SunRail comes in. I think it's not a foregone conclusion perhaps, but widely recognized that to the extent that you don't have riders changing the mode of transportation going from a rail to a bus, that you're going to increase ridership. So I think we'll have to look very closely about our ability to have a seamless connection, rail connection from SunRail to the airport. but in this economic environment, it's difficult, I think, to predict with any degree of certainty whether you can have a rail system built or not on airport.
I'm talking with Phil Brown. He's executive director of the Greater Orlando Aviation Authority, and you're listening to Intersection. Phil, if one could put any criticism towards the Orlando International Airport, it's on the international side of things. People have harped for years saying that they want a new international terminal out there. And I recently had the opportunity to take a tour and was told that the infrastructure is largely in place for something like that to be built. But at this moment, there's a question of money and how much capacity is being demanded of the airport. What's the latest on building a new terminal?
Well, that's, again, part of the focus that we have in this master plan update is to refine our demand predictions on international traffic. That has been our fastest growing component. It's roughly about 10%, order of magnitude about 3 million plus passengers a year. But we don't have the terminal facilities. There are some other infrastructure improvements, roadways, taxiways that will have to be developed to accommodate that. And it's going to be a fairly large ticket item, a large price to pay. And as you know, in dealing with Orlando Airport, it's one of the attractions is that most of the airlines that travel here have pretty affordable rates because most of the traffic is leisure traffic. They shop the pricing. So the airlines are not inclined to pay for a lot of costs that are not going to directly benefit them. So we have to work out, I think, some creative funding opportunities. We're going to have to look, I think, for some participation from the federal government to the extent that they have funding. We all know that they're challenged in order to make this work. So it's not an easy template to execute in terms of the funding. So I think we need to plan on it, determine what the number of facilities are, make it affordable, and have it in keeping with the Orlando experience. All that's a pretty tall order, but I think that we're committed to trying to accomplish that.
Can you explain maybe just a little bit more on that? You mentioned keeping things affordable with the airlines, and then, of course, you've got the cost associated with building a whole new terminal. What's the correlation there between, you know, creating that new terminal and airline prices? Are you saying in some way that airline prices could go up if to help pay for a new terminal, or what's that connection?
Well, airline prices are dictated by more of a macroeconomic factors, oil prices. I mean, the largest operational component to airline fares is fuel. It's 35% of their operating costs. It's very unpredictable. If you look at the fluctuations in fuel over the last 6 months, as an example, it's been very volatile. So to say that the cost of the airport is going to dictate that, it will impact the decisions of airlines to utilize the terminal. And the way that our financial models work is that we need some commitment from the airlines. Currently, going into the third year of a five-year agreement with the airlines for the current facilities. But what we've done over the years is look for other opportunities that generate revenue other than from the airlines. If you look at our current North Terminal and you look at, for example, the rent-a-car market. Rent-a-car market is, we say it's the largest in the United States. I mean, you can make what all marketing claims you want. From a practical standpoint, in our revenue stream, the fees and the rents that the rental car companies pay to us at the airport are about $70 million a year. Well, that's $70 million towards costs that airlines don't have to pay. In the scheme of things, in our total revenue budget, airlines generate about 30% of the revenue to us. The other 70% comes from rental cars, parking, concessions, things like that. So that's how going to a new terminal that you're going to have to leverage that same kind of approach in that provide opportunities that revenues can be generated clearly off of the passenger traffic, but they're not direct payments from the airlines to the airport for the use of the facilities.
What do you see as the airport's biggest competition in the future?
Well, I mean, competition is a concern, but I think the overall concern that we have is the strength of the economy, because that drives air traffic. I mean, and that's what we do is air traffic. So what we are concerned with are the demand, particularly on the domestic side of the market. Even though we're growing international, 90% of the market's domestic. What drives that? It's the economy. People wanting to come here. For the most part, they're coming here for leisure activities, but not so much as they were in the past. I've seen estimates that 30% of our traffic is here for business reasons. Business traffic is typically less price sensitive than leisure traffic. So to the extent that the economy falters, then that's a challenge. In the international market, we think that's a growing opportunity, because the fares there are usually higher. Airlines are usually able to make more profit off of that. So I think we are in competition with international gateways across the United States: Houston, Atlanta, Miami, Tampa, to the extent that they want to be an international gateway. To some degree, we're in a little bit of competition with Sanford, but we can coexist. Competition's not a bad thing. It's something that makes everybody sharpen their pencils and perform better.
And on the immediate horizon, what's the next thing coming up for you?
Well, the next thing that's coming up for us is completing this master plan and trying to address some of these planning issues that we have, developing a five-year capital plan. And in 2012, we'll be in negotiations again with airlines on a lease agreement that will expire in 2013. And those plans and that capital improvement program that we develop will be key discussion points with the airlines. We also are, I mean, in the immediate future, we're going to be marketing to Brazil. Brazil is a very strong economy right now. We have a lot of Brazilian visitors here. The traffic from Brazil has increased. It's our fastest growing segment of international. So that's going to be immediate. The midterm, we're going to finish the master plan effort, and then we're going to be into negotiations with airlines.
We've been talking with Phil Brown, Executive Director of the Greater Orlando Aviation Authority. Phil, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Ahead, how local leaders acquired the land where the airport was built for $1. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM, Orlando. How much is a dollar worth to you? Well, that's how much local leaders paid in 1975 for 3,000 acres east of Orlando, where the Orlando International Airport eventually would flourish. Lou Fry was a young congressman then. Today, he is an attorney at Lowndes, Drostek, Doster, Kanner, and Reed. You know him as a regular political commentator here on Intersection. Lou, good to have you with us.
Thank you. And Dick, see you. Where do you go? I lost him, but I'm much happier with who we have.
Well, that's true. We usually have Dick Batchelor in that chair when we've got Lou Fry here, but today we have Sarah Van Ardstel, who is director of the Orange County Regional History Center. Sarah, good to have you.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be with a good old friend, Lou.
Amen.
Well, you know, let's turn back the clock a little bit, if we can, to what was Orlando in the late 60s, the early 70s? Walt Disney World, 1971, had only just opened. Orlando's growth explosion was starting to pick up speed, but the region lacked a strong airport. There was a military base where the Orlando International Airport is today, and that was McCoy Air Force Base, but it had been scheduled to close. Lou Fry, help paint us the picture of what was Orlando like in those days.
It was really a hick town. We really had some potential going for us, but we had a lot of problems. We lost 10,000 jobs in transferring to the shuttle. We had started a college here, Charlie Grant, a lot of local people have, that was going to open in 69, was just starting. I was a young congressman. The first thing they did is take away the Navy base and move it to a Democrats district, Bob Sykes district, up in the north part. By the way, that was about 22,000 jobs at the time that went, and without an airport and everything, we were going nowhere.
Was it clear that Orlando needed one?
Oh yes, I mean, my goodness, and when the Secretary of Defense called me over to his office and said he's closing both at Patrick Air Force Base and McCoy, I called the White House and asked for a job because it was clear I was going to be out of a job if they had gone ahead and done that. I mean, it would have been total disaster.
So, Sarah, what was the political scene both locally and nationally looking at this idea of bringing a big airport into Orlando? The growth spurt had already started, but was it clear just how far it was going to go at that point?
No, I don't think it was clear at all. I think that because this was largely still Democratic area, and this was a blip on the radar. I mean, nobody really thought anything about it. While Disney World was here in 1973, you had the opening of SeaWorld, and the year after that, you had Wet n' Wild. So the things were starting to happen, but you also had major demographic changes. You had downtown, which was dying, downtown Orlando. Yeah. You had the rise of the suburbs. You had Martin Marietta, which was just starting. Lou did mention, of course, the college. You had all these little things.
It became evident, though, with all the groups that wanted, once it became identified that we were going to do something with the airport and I was in charge, we had Paul Pickett, who was the chairman of the Orange County Commission. Orange County wanted it. Yes. Osceola County wanted it. Everybody wanted the property, so people knew that it was going to be really important down the line. So there's a real scramble here of who was going to be the supplicants in getting the property.
Lou Fry, at that point, though, there's a number of military-based closures that are going through, and you have to navigate these waters where you've got Richard Nixon, who in 1974 resigned from the presidency. Yeah. How do you work those political waters, and what clout did you have?
This fortunately was before Nixon resigned. And by the way, he came down to speak as I was the Nixon youth chairman with Julie Nixon, Eisenhower, and George Bush the Elder in that. And I was put in a position where I had to go fight with the Secretary of Defense, who did take Patrick off it, but wouldn't take McCoy off it. And so I was put in charge of trying to navigate this thing and do something about the base and make it an airport that we could use.
What did you think about that base actually closing? Because McCoy was part of Strategic Air Command. There was B-52 bombers there and other kinds of refueling aircraft. Were you concerned about it for the defense angle or for what's going to happen when those military jobs go away for the community? What was your view on it?
Well, my view first is we needed the base, and I thought they should have kept it. Frankly, and we had not only the B-52s, but we had the WVs, Willie Victors, that I'd flown in, which were patrolled aircraft that we flew out of here, and they were taken out. And what happened is we got the White House to push, and the property and McCoy, as you said, the 3,000 acres and all that, was pushed on the disposable list for the military. That means that any military facility in the country had priority getting that piece of property. So they were all lined up salivating at it, and it was the White House that said, hey, wait a minute, no, Fry's in charge of it, you know, you got to work through a process. And once we got through the military part of it, then we had to go with the GSA. And then it was open to any civilian who wanted the deal, and we had to fight behind the scenes a lot of people from grabbing that property for different uses, not necessarily an airport.
Now, eventually, you work out a deal where the military gives away the base for a dollar.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Well, about 4 years' worth of work and everything, and cooperation of the community and the leaders in the community. And it was not an I thing. It was a we thing. And it was I just happened to be in the hot seat at the right place, and I had the right political clout as it happened. And if it had been 74, this finally happened in 74, but if we'd have been 2 years later on this thing, it had never happened. Nixon wouldn't have had the clout, and Watergate would have had another victim, and that would have been Orlando and the Air Force Base.
But I also think that certainly the leaders, when they realized that this was opportunity, I think Carl Langford, Mayor Langford, really had a critical role in playing in also working with everyone to get this property for the airport. He knew, just like everyone knew, the real need of the community for an airport and how important it was for the growth of the community. And
he was my guy. He when I ran for governor He said he never endorsed the politician, but he endorsed me. But we couldn't favor Carl Langford or anybody. We had everybody out there, and we had to be very careful that we gave everybody a hearing and so forth and so on. I will say this, and they can't, it's statute of limitations is run. I certainly favored the city getting it because they were better prepared. The city was better prepared than anybody in getting the property.
What do you think was the most contentious issue in getting this airport deal through, Sarah?
Probably just the transfer from military to civilian. I think that would have been potentially contentious.
Was that an unusual transaction at that time?
Yeah, there were bases being closed, and there were transfer of bases, though, Mark. And so the fact that you could go from the military and that without a great deal of money was something. But this was an incredible base with $25 million worth of development on it, and of course
facilities,
the runways,
already,
the facilities.
Yeah.
I mean, we had a hangar you'd go to take a plane out that when it rained, we had buckets where the rain would
that
come into.
That was what we call the Orlando Executive Airport. That was the main airport, and it was really a poor stage. And I think people saw that and they thought, we don't want this to be this.
That was the gateway.
Yeah, that was the gateway to the community,
at that time.
And it was really, really awful.
What role did the airport have once completed on accelerating growth in this region, do you think?
I think they were the key.
I think they were the
driving force. Before, we had a lot of separate things going on. When that airport came in many ways it solidified what was going on, and it was a real driving force, and the people at the Airport Authority, the directors of it and that, really played an incredible part in having this growth in this community.
I also think one thing that helped was the presence of the space program and Martin Marietta, and that made this – that was a quiet thing that also helped to
– The spillover of it. You
yes,
mean. Yeah,
the
right.
spillover – helped to bring the focus on Orlando.
One of the funny things about it was when we were trying to keep this thing going, and that the Secretary of Navy, John Chafee, who ended up in the Senate and came down
from Rhode Island.
From Rhode Island. He was sent down here by President Nixon to find out what was going on. And I've got pictures of him touring with me this area and looking at it. If you want to see a guy who had a bad stomach, you know, and I had pictures of him just glowering at me. Funny thing about that, 20 years later, I retire from the Congress, I get a letter from John Chafee saying, Lou, he said, I bet they still remember you for what you did to me. And I got that letter from him, which was, he changed his mind is what happened. It became part of helping us grow and keeping the other military entities away from us.
Well, I've been speaking with 90.7 political commentator, former Congressman Lou Frey. Lou, thanks for taking us inside the history there.
It's a pleasure. It really is. It's great to be with Sarah.
And also speaking with Sarah Von Ardstel, who is executive director of the Orange County Regional History Center. Sarah, great to have you in.
Thank you so much.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.